Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome back to Overnight America. I saw a text message that came in. This hurts a little bit. This hurts. He said, I turn into KMOX and this is all I hear. That's me crying about the Loop Trolley. Come on. No, I don't talk about the Loop Trolley a lot. I probably went 2 months without talking about it, and it just happens to be relevant again because they're out there asking for $700,000. I don't sound like this all the time, do I? Is that what happens when you normally turn on Overnight America? It's not much of a baby crying. It's more like belly aching. I feel there's a distinction between the two. There's this. That's me crying over something. But me belly aching means I have a grievance or I have some sort of issue that I want to air out there. And I give you the opportunity to air these things too. I'm not the only one that has grievances to air. I tried to find the Josh Hawley clip that Alex Degman played at the news at the top of the hour, but I couldn't find it fast enough before the news break was over. But is this it right here? I think this might be it.
I want to say it's such a privilege for me to support the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act in the United States Congress. I look forward to working to get it passed and standing with you as you stand for your rights and liberties.
Okay, that's not it. There's one of them. Is it... He used the term Hong Kongers, and I had to look that up. I thought, is that the right term? And apparently it is. Hong Kongers, also known as the Hong Kongese or the Hong Kong citizens, usually refer to the residents of Hong Kong in a broad sense. I didn't know that. I learned something new. I thought he was making up a term there. So I had to double check that sort of thing. Josh Hawley's an educated dude, I understand, but still, that term didn't seem all that correct. Here's what we got for this hour. We're going to talk to an author by the name of Tony McAleer, and he wrote a book called The Cure for Hate. It's an interesting book, mostly because he's someone that grew up as a white supremacist, a neo-Nazi. He's someone that went around beating people up. And what changed in his life in order to turn things around? And what is he doing now to help other people that were like him? It's an interesting life of Tony McAleer. We're going to talk to him this hour, too. And there's a story on Fox News about a Dutch family that was found living in a cellar. How long do you think you could hold off living in a cellar? Now, we don't know if all these people were related, but there were several people living in this bunker for an extended period of time because they thought the world was about to end. So they hunkered down to save themselves. They thought that all civilization was lost. Or at least one person inside of the bunker told them that. And then they stayed down there for, guess how long? We'll tell you later. So you're going to have to wait. It's a long time. How long could you hunker down for something like that? And also later, I wanted to talk about two stories, sports story-wise, that one of which impacts us here in St. Louis. Did you see that story in the Post-Dispatch? About the Cardinal Rittner player, the one that has the tattoos on his arm. I didn't realize you can get a full arm of tattoos in high school. I didn't realize that was a thing that high schoolers are going out and getting full sleeves of tattoos. But nonetheless, there was a player that was suspended for a game. So it happened, the infraction happened apparently at the last game of last season, which means the suspension would have taken place game one of this season. And instead of him sitting out, they have video and photo evidence of this guy, the kid, for high school player, that suited up under a different name and a different number in order to fool everyone to think that he was actually suspended. So they put someone else into the box score, whatever it was. So he was an ineligible player, and he's played 7 games so far, still ineligible. It could wipe out their entire season. This is one of the highest-rated teams in the state of Missouri. The Missouri Media Class 2 poll puts them at number 1, the number 1-ranked small school. So it could completely wipe them out total. What were they thinking? What were they thinking, seriously? And with the photos, what it shows is they got a picture of this quote-unquote rookie that they decided to put in that was super good, has all the matching tattoos. So it's there's a lot of evidence against this team's case. So whoever decided to do that, bad, bad mistake. One other thing I wanted to talk to, Super Bowl champions put a blast out for a football league coach after he was fined $500 for a victory. So apparently the coach is being accused of running up the score in this youth football league. And a lot of people are sounding off and saying this is ridiculous that you would fine and suspend this coach over having these players play. And it's not like they ran the score up all that much. It was like 30 points, right? It's not like crazy. In football, when a touchdown and a field goal is 7 points, or if you just score a touchdown and it's 6 points, getting to 30 points is not that difficult in football. So to say that you won by 33 points and that's finable in youth football is insane. So we'll talk about that later too. Up next, our guest, we're going to talk about growing up with so much hate in your heart. What was the cure for that? Tony McAleer joins us on KMOX.
Listening to KMOX has never been easier.
Siri, play KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And joining us now is the author of the book, The Cure for Hate, Tony McAleer. Thank you for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you for having me.
So The Cure for Hate, a former white supremacist journey from violent extremism to radical compassion. Quite an interesting book, which is now out. So I wanted to talk to you about your history and how you got to where you were radicalized. You grew up in Canada?
That's right. In an affluent, middle-class neighborhood. My father was a doctor, psychiatrist. I suppose you could maybe blame some of it on that. Went to private school and all that kind of thing. So I didn't come from a broken home, or visibly broken anyways, and I didn't come from economic hardship. But, you know, things happened in the house where I found myself really, really angry. When I was 9, I walked in on my dad with another woman. And that was when the God fell off the pedestal. Mm. I don't know if you can remember when that happened in your life, but it's part of the human condition, I suppose. And I felt betrayed, confused, angry. And I started acting out at school, and I went from listening to Elton John and Queen to The Clash and the Sex Pistols. And being an all-boys Catholic school, and they still had corporal punishment then. As my grades slid, they tried everything to get me to do better at school. And when the carrot didn't work, they used the stick. If I didn't get an A or a B on major tests or assignments, I was hit on the rear end with a yardstick.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What years were you going to school? Like, when did you graduate high school?
I graduated in 1985.
Yeah. Well, what...
So it would have been the late 70s.
Yeah. Where did you go to high school?
I went to Vancouver. So by the time I was 14, finished grade 9, you know, the school had enough of my rebellious ways. And, you know, they said to my parents, like, not any one thing he's done worthy of expulsion, but his general level of defiance is off the chart. And, you know, we've had enough. We give up. And so to take him somewhere else at the end of the year and you know, we'll wash our hands of it and we won't expel him. And so that was what happened. And I was born in England and I grew up in Vancouver. I came to Vancouver when I was at the age of 2, and you know, I wanted just to get away from everything, and I wanted to go explore my British roots and and all of that kind of thing. So I went to boarding school in England for a year.
Wow, for a year. So your parents decided to spend all that money to send you out there. Did they feel like this was going to be the thing to help correct you?
Yeah, I think they thought that way, but, you know, being the one of two Catholics at a Methodist boarding school that I chose because it was co-ed and none of the Catholic ones were, they were all same-sex kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, as a 14-year-old boy, I did not make the wisest choice in boarding school, and it didn't take long before, you know, I was having difficulties with some of the other students who were the children of British Army kids stationed abroad. And, you know, my dad grew up in the Irish Catholic slums of Liverpool.
Huh.
So it was a recipe for conflict, shall we say.
Yeah. So joining us now is the author of the book called The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion, author Tony McAleer. Now, is it in England, is this the time you start to get introduced to some of these more radical ideas?
Yeah, I was into punk, but at the same time, what came out of the punk scene was the skinhead scene, and it wasn't political at the time. There was fringes of it that were engaged with groups like the National Front, but what I liked about them is they were tough. They were like super patriotic, ultra nationalist British, and Union Jack t-shirts and all that stuff. And I remember when I came back, I went to go see my first punk show, which was Black Flag with Henry Rollins. And I'm standing outside this venue to go in, and these two skinheads walk down the line, and they noticed my Doc Martens, which were a dime a dozen in England, but rare and expensive back here in North America. And they stop and go, what size feet you have? And I know why they're asking, because they're going to rob me for my boots if they fit. It was kind of like Cinderella, but in a malevolent way. And those two guys, I said my size 7.5, and they said, no, I won't fit. And looked on, but those two guys became my best friends and my bullying survival strategy, because I was a kid that was bright, but tough, maybe got in three fights in the schoolyard all throughout school kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But these guys were tough. These guys grew up with violence in the home, and they terrified everybody, and befriend the bully, became the bully with my bullying survival strategy. And in order for me to have their protection, I had to have their respect. And in order for me to have their respect, I had to commit all the same violence that they did. And somebody said to me, Tony, you seem like such a nice guy. How did you lose your humanity? And I said, I didn't lose it. I traded it for acceptance and approval till there was nothing left.
What kind of things were you doing at that time to gain their approval?
We're just beating people up. Anyone that give us the slightest disrespect, we often provoked the disrespect. So it'd have to be some ridiculous reason. But the one that I'm most shameful of is we were drinking by the aquatic center in Vancouver, which is a big pool and parking lot underneath the bridge. And it's an indoor pool. And that area was where gay men used to go cruising. And so we were sitting around and, park bench, and people going by, and we're hurling empty beer cans and insults at them. And finally, one tells us to F off. And there we have the manufactured disrespect that we created. And we chased them, and we chased them into like a crawl space. It was a construction site at the other side of the parking lot. And imagine like a kitchen table in height. Mm-hmm. And in there, we couldn't go in after them. And, we were so disconnected, we picked up stones, like skipping stones you would at the lake. We were like kids at the lake playing a game. And we skipped these stones into underneath this crawl space, and you'd hear clack, 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 clack. And every third or fourth stone, you'd hear the yell of pain. From this man who didn't deserve any of it. And what bothers me the most is that, if I think back to all the times that I was taken into that office and hit with the yardstick, I knew what it was like to be somewhere where, something really bad was about to happen. There's nothing you could do about it.
Yeah.
I knew what it felt like to be completely helpless, to be completely powerless in that moment to stop what was happening.
Wow. How many?
And then I chose to project that onto somebody else.
How many years did this go on for you?
I'd say five or six. And by the time we were becoming more politically organized and the cops knew who we were and that kind of thing, we didn't dare step out of line, although, we often did for fear of getting charged and stuff. And I went from wearing Doc Martens and combat pants and combat jacket and a shaved head to a suit and tie. And while I encouraged violence with my rhetoric and with my narrative, because I was so high profile, I stayed away from actually participating in it myself.
Mm. When you start to see the change, this organization side of things, you said that you became even recognized by the police. So what did they call your organization?
We had the Aryan Resistance Movement, which became Canada's largest neo-Nazi skinhead organization across Canada with 13 chapters. Mm-hmm. And so then you make it onto the intelligence radars.
How does that work? You're like 5 years into this sort of thing. Is there meetings, or do you just for those 5 years were you just going to public places and harassing people?
Well, it started out very chaotic and sort of being skinheads drinking and fighting, and that was sort of the lifestyle, right? And soccer hooliganism, and it was all very chaotic. And I, at that, that stoning of the game, and that was like maybe 1984. By about that time, a year later, the music had turned extremely racist and white power. And then what happened is 2 years after that, by around 87 and 88, traditional organized racist groups made contact with these sort of seemingly out of control skinhead youth. They saw muscle and an infusion of youth, and we saw a chance to become more organized and more effective and be part of these other older groups. And that's when I think the ADL talked about 1988 as the summer that it exploded, and there was an explosion of violence across North America perpetrated by skinheads.
Did you stay primarily in Vancouver during this time, or were you guys traveling? Because you see, like today, when you see some of these different groups, they'll travel to different rallies into multiple cities. You see that some of them, like here in the United States, even modern, like we see that some of the Nazi parties or any of the skinheads, they'll go. And they'll go to like these different rallies in different cities, and you notice it's all like the 10 or 15 same people that show up to these things. It's not like there's any local organization. It's like there's only very few of them around.
No. But don't let those numbers fool you. If you looked at the Irish Republican Army at the height of the Troubles, it was only 75 guys that would pull triggers or plant bombs. The amount of chaos that can be created by a very small, tight group of people dedicated to that political violence, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a mass movement.
Yeah.
And we should sort of never lose sight of that. But I traveled across Canada as well as up and down the coast.
The book is out now. It's called The Cure for Hate, and his website, thecureforhate.ca. a former white supremacist's journey from violent extremism to radical compassion. We'll talk about what changed for him and how he turned his life around coming up next. Our guest is author Tony McAleer on KMOX.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
The book is out now. It's called The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist's Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. And author Tony McAleer joining us on KMOX. What changed for you? What got you out of that?
Well, it was sparked by the birth of my daughter. And I had a son 15 months later, but in the delivery room, I was handed this, you know, beautiful, fragile little baby girl. And you know, when she opened her eyes and my face was the first picture her brain was going to take, you know, and I realized I was responsible. And I accepted the responsibility for this child, because up until this point, I was completely disconnected and I was operating out of narcissism and ego. Mm-hmm. You know, I was an attention whore and just doing things to get a rise out of people, to get notoriety, to do all of those things. Now, for the first time ever, I had to think about somebody other than myself. Mm-hmm. And my son, 15 months later, and I got to parent him the way that I always wanted to be parented. My dad was a really great provider, but he didn't have much time. He, as a psychiatrist, he was working 60, 78 hours a week. So I didn't see him that much. And, you know, I went to all my son's 5 a.m. hockey practices and it was sort of cathartic and very healing to break that cycle. Mm-hmm. And children provide an amazing gift for us because, you know, and I talk in the book about toxic shame. And it's this sense that we're less than, we're flawed, we're unlovable, we're invisible.
Yeah.
And we live our lives in reaction to that. But children, they don't see the flaws when they look at us. Hmm. You know, they see the magnificence that we can't see, that I was incapable of seeing when I looked in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first experience with compassion. And what they taught me was, you know, when we're compassionate with someone, we hold a mirror up and allow them to see their humanity reflected back at them. I could, through the eyes of my children, begin to see my humanity when otherwise I was completely disconnected from it. Yeah. And I truly believe that the level to which we dehumanize other human beings is a mirror reflection of how internally disconnected and dehumanized we are. Mm.
So what happened to your life after that moment? You leave the Aryan resistance, you turn a new lifestyle. What happens to you after that?
Well, there wasn't any group like Life After Hate around to help. So I left the movement, but the movement hadn't left me. So the challenge for me, and this is a very common challenge, is ideology and identity were completely intertwined. That's why it's difficult to argue with someone entrenched in the ideology and change them in any way, because you're actually attacking their identity, not their ideology. So my rationalization was, I'd gone to the Supreme Court of Canada twice with my racist phone line, and I said to myself, you know, why should I fight for a bunch of white people who couldn't care whether I lived or died? Mm. If I'm going to contribute to the white race, I'll make sure these two children thrive and survive. And at that point, I was a single father full time. Mm-hmm. And that was the lie, the rationalization that I told myself to keep my identity intact, yet leave the movement behind. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until about 6 years later that I was introduced to a guy that helped me heal. Mm-hmm. You know, the wounds that made the ideology attractive. I just want to be just very clear here for your audience. I don't blame anything I did on stuff that happened in my childhood. I share it with you so that you can understand the lens through which I made those decisions. Everything I did, I chose to do, and I have to be accountable and responsible for my actions, and it's why I do the work that I do.
Yeah.
The analogy, you ever gone to the grocery store when you're really hungry and you shop from the middle aisles and the chips or the cookies or whatever you think of mine's chips? Nobody makes us put that thing in the basket, but, mm-hmm. you know, we're drawn to it. And I like to use the analogy. I went out into the world emotionally hungry, and I made horrific choices that provided a fleeting moment of satisfaction at the expense of people who didn't deserve it.
Yeah. You know, as you try to raise your kids and you're a different person after that point, did you ever have a conversation with them what your life was like before they were born?
Yeah. They know my history, but they know I'm not my history. And they both read the book before it was published, but we had talked before then. And the guy that had healed me, he spent some time with them as well. You know, 2005, I started working with sort of coach and mentor. He did all these public workshops on personal growth and personal development. And as I was in a new career as a financial advisor and things were taking off, and I just, you know, as I followed the advice and the lessons that I learned about myself, my life really started to improve. Mm-hmm. And so after about 8 months of doing these courses, everything's starting to really improve. My relationship with my kids is improving. The guy who introduced us gives me an envelope and goes, there, for my birthday. And it's, I open it up, and it's a gift certificate for a one-on-one counseling session with this guy. Mm-hmm. Like, who doesn't want therapy for their birthday, right? And so I go and see the guy, and, you know, I tell him about my parents. I tell him I'm angry in the school and the beatings, and I'm hesitant to tell him anymore, because when people had found out about my past, that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And it was the end of the relationship. And you know, for most people, rightly so. And so this is a relationship I valued. I liked him. He was helping me heal and get out of my own way. So I'm humming and hawing, and he goes, look, mate, it's okay. He's English, but 10 years older, from Manchester. I'm from Liverpool. And we bonded over quirky things like Monty Python. And he says, you look like you're trying to swallow 3 golf balls. Just let it out. And so I spit it out, and I give him the Reader's Digest of all the horrible stuff that I'd been into. And the more I tell him, the more he smiles. The more he smiles, the more annoyed I get. I'm just, like, I'm here in my first therapy session. This guy's laughing at me. Like, what kind of bad place is this? And I go, what's so funny? And he leans in with a big, huge grin on his face, and he said, you know, I'm Jewish, right? And of course, you know, the irony of that. And here's this man who loves me,
yeah,
wants to heal me, wants to see the best for me and my kids and all of that. And I'm sinking into my chair in shame, knowing that I'd once advocated for the annihilation of him and his people.
Yeah.
But there's that receiving compassion, receiving it from someone who we don't feel we deserve it from, receiving it from someone who we've dehumanized is an incredibly powerful experience. Yeah. And so from there, I did about 1,000 hours of one-on-one and group counseling work with him to put me back in touch with little Tony. You know, the core essence of who I came into the world to be at the age of 2, 3, 4.
Wow. You know, what a story. What a transformation. If people wanted to check out The Cure for Hate, where can they find your book?
I signed up Amazon, thecureforhate.ca. Arsenal Pulp is the publisher. Barnes & Noble, all the major online retailers. And there's advice for families. There's advice on how to respond to white nationalism when it shows up in your neighborhood, and mm-hmm. how to practice radical compassion and inspire others to courageous lives of compassion. Mm. And in doing so, you'll change the world.
Thecureforhate.ca. You can learn more on the website Life After Hate. But a former white supremacist journey from violent extremism to radical compassion. Tony McAleer, thank you so much for sharing your story here tonight on KMOX.
Thank you for having me.
What a story. Wow. And he joins us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
Watching from the bleachers was your biggest fan, 11-year-old producer Mike Anderson.
Wow, I don't think that I'll ever get old. Is it possible that we'll ever get old? I don't know.
Stop it.
Okay, maybe I will. Maybe it's time I stop it. Thanks for everyone that is hanging out with us here tonight. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Recker. And you can also listen back to any part of the show whenever you would like at KMOX.com/ONA. And from what I understand, the radio.com app, you can get our podcast on there. But you can also listen to KMOX Live, and you can also rewind live radio that way, which is a strange concept, but it's kind of cool that they're doing that. Yeah, it's almost like you're in control of all space and time, like a super villain in a movie. We all know if you had that capability, you wouldn't use it for good. You'd use it for evil. Honestly, people, that's how they would use it. I saw this one story on Fox News. How long could you be in a very close quarter with your family? Like, how long? Real, I'll just ask you, Producer Mike. Let's say we're talking doomsday bunker. You think it's the end of the world. You think that there's just going to be all the different countries firing their nukes on each other. And the only chance of survival is to get into a bunker and hunker down until it's all over. How long could you stay with your immediate family before you go crazy and say, you know what, I'll risk the radiation?
I don't think I would go crazy. I'm pretty lucky. I like my family. We all get along. So I think it'd be, I mean, not ideal, obviously, but if I had to pick a family, they're good ones to be stuck with.
Hmm. All right. That's
Although I am the only boy with three sisters, so.
Oh, you're done.
Haven't experienced that in about a decade, 15 years since I've lived with all them, so
well,
who knows.
Things will go sour really quick between them. That's how it works with sisters. Okay, there was a family of seven that was discovered living in the cellar. And the authorities in the Netherlands are starting to give us a picture of what happened. So they believe that this family of seven was living in this isolated farm bunker waiting for the end of time because they thought it was going to happen at any given time. Six adults between the ages of 18 and 25 and then a 58-year-old man. And what ended up happening was a 25-year-old man, what they believe is the 58-year-old son, apparently escaped, walked into a pub in the nearby town. It was completely confused because they thought all humanity was wiped off the face of the earth. They realized he was unkempt, he had long hair, he needed help, and he's never been to school, uneducated, all of these things. They discover that when they take him back to this farm, that the family was under this bunker for 9 years. 9 years! Whoa! What do you think that place smelt like? Ugh. That's the first thing I'd want to know. I don't know if there's a hazmat suit that can keep that smell off you. But there, look at that. I mean, how could you have six adults, and a 58-year-old? So six adults between 18 and 25 and a 58-year-old. How do you survive something like that? In all reality, how do you even prepare for 9 years? I know you can go to Costco and get like a multi-year supply of mac and cheese, but still, how big was this bunker? What were they doing for 9 years? How did they keep their sanity? How did they, because they had no communication with the outside world. They didn't have radio, didn't have television. They had no idea anything existed. So was it a situation where they had like a DVD player and a bunch of episodes of The Office and they watch that for 9 straight years? How else do you keep yourself sane? So the owner of the pub called the police. The police got out there. They said it's unlike anything they've ever seen before. So there was a secret staircase to this underground bunker behind a cupboard in a living room. The group lived in a space, had no contact with the outside world, according to the television station. The 6 younger members of the group reportedly had no idea there were other humans in the world. A neighbor said that every once in a while they saw the man out on the farm and was totally surprised by this, had no idea the guy had any family. So he was sneaking up and apparently grabbing things from the house or whatever. I don't know if it was a scenario where he would dress himself up to say, you know, I'm going to save yourself. Don't go out. You don't need to be in contact with this radiation or whatever it is. And then he would go up there and just create a continuous lie for these years after years after years. Maybe for the family, they thought it was just a thing of survival. They thought, hey, if the only way I'm alive is because I'm down here, so I'm not going to go up. Wow, what a crazy, crazy thing. I wonder if people read stories like this and they think, you know, it's probably not a bad idea that I start preparing for worst case scenarios. Because if I were to have to go down to my basement right now, I might be able to live, how long? How long would you be able to live? Half a week before you run out of water and food? Something like that? It's probably not a bad idea to stockpile some cans of non-perishable types of food, liquid, water, things like that. And maybe at least have a game plan for your family, because if it's not a doomsday scenario, it could be an earthquake that hits here in Missouri. There's a story that Megan Lynch put up on KMOX.com. It has to do with, what if a big one hits Missouri? I mean, we're right on a fault line. There could be millions of people without power. What do you think that plays? How do you think that plays out? You know, the emergency crews can't get to everyone at the same time. Imagine if you're out of power for a month. Imagine if you you can't access the roads, or maybe there's an injury and it's just a pure chaos going on and the big one hits right here. How does that work? Go get yourself prepared. All right. Now that I brought the worst out and we're in survival mode, we got one more hour of Overnight America coming up. We haven't taken many calls tonight, so let's talk youth football. Should a small youth football team's coach be fined and suspended for running up the score? We'll talk about that next. It's Overnight America. Game Boys!
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.